I'm delighted to welcome back to the program Adam Harvey. He is actor and performer in the one-man show Don't Panic, It's Only Finnegan's Wake. It's at Teatro Paraguas this weekend, Friday and Saturday, January 31st and February 1st at 7 o'clock, and then on Sunday at 2 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's a real pleasure to be here.
So you have the distinction of, I'm guessing here, but perhaps you are the only person on the planet, including many tenured professors specializing in James Joyce, who have actually memorized 6 hours of Finnegan's Wake. And that is no mean feat, because it's in a kind of made-up dialect of English, really. A lot of the words aren't even words, and it's considered one of the most difficult works of fiction in the English language.
Well, it depends on what you mean by difficult. If it means painstaking and time-consuming to work on the text, yeah, I would call it difficult. But there was a time, I think, when Finnegan's Wake was a really, really hard book to read. But we live in a new age now. We live in the world of Google and so on. And after about 75 years of people working on the text, they've discovered the source material, and they've come up with all sorts of ways to make that accessible. There's a website now and so on. And so,
like,
yeah,
annotated, so you can go through it word by word and figure out what things mean.
There's this amazing website now called fweet.org, fweet.org. This fellow in Tel Aviv, Raphael Slepon, just sat down, and first of all, he typed in everything from Roland McHugh's books on Finnegan's Wake, and then started culling stuff from scholars. I've contributed to it. You know, so many people have. And it's astounding how much you can get just having a look at that website. So, yeah, there's no excuse anymore. You know, truly, truly.
Well, not that anybody needs an excuse for not reading Finnegan's Wake.
Hey, okay, no, fair enough. It is something for the enthusiast. But for me, I can't understand why people don't feel the same enthusiasm that I do.
Well, this is the beautiful thing about the performance that you do. And you did one, I think it was about 8 years ago or so, 7 or 8 years ago, you did a performance of Finnegan's Wake, which was very different from the one that you're doing now.
Yeah, yeah.
But what you do is you know large passages of it by heart, and you not only recite them, but perform them in a way that, to me, it opens up the text in a way that reading it couldn't do, because there are some passages that are references to songs. You sing them.
Right.
There are some that are references to nursery rhymes or fables,
sure,
and you
sure.
say them in that way, and therefore make it more accessible.
Right. Now, I should say that, you know, this business about me being the only person to memorize, you know, 6 hours and so on, it may or may not be true. I would not necessarily consider myself a pioneer, though, because I think about, in particular, Patrick Horgan, who recorded the entire book for the National Foundation for the Blind and did this amazing job of really working on each and every word, how should it be pronounced, and recorded it. And unfortunately, the recording at this point is only available for the reading impaired. But in any case, the point is the work has been done. And I do think that it is a good supplement to the kind of work that Roland McHugh and Raphael Slepon did before, because you don't really get an idea of the structure of the sentences. Like, the syntax of Finnegan's Wake isn't annotated. And the only way you can do that, I mean, aside from, say, doing those giant, like, outlines like you see in Noam Chomsky's books, you know, where one sentence gets branched out into this giant tree and it gets all confusing, actually. The other way is to have an actor sit down and read it out loud. And, yeah, you do get a very strong sense of what's going on. You do.
Is there any evidence that the book was meant to be read aloud, that Joyce read it aloud, or that he wanted other people to do so?
Joyce recorded a few pages of the book himself on gramophone. It's a fine recording, too, considering when it was made and everything. It's really nice, clear diction, and that's another thing. You know, no need to scour the bookstores anymore. There are YouTubes where people have animated a photograph of Joyce as if he were actually reciting it for you, and everything. Accessible is just the word of the day when describing this stuff. And yeah, Joyce recorded it, and he intended it to be said out loud. I mean, there is a value, by the way, and this is one of the changes that I've made to my performance art. The value of seeing the text, though, there's a huge value to it, because a lot of the words, when pronounced, do kind of have an odd sound to it. There's deliberate distortion to them. But if you look at the word, you're going to go, oh, I get it now. There's one in particular in this passage that I'm looking at right now, in which the word exile is turned into aches-iled, and it's A-C-H-E-S-E-Y-E-L-D, as in my eyes ache. And Joyce had terrible iritis and had like 20 eye surgeries. So, you know, he just thought about his own exile as an, you know, from Ireland, and his own eye troubles, and they became conflated in this single word. And you're not going to get the pun unless you see the word. And
so if you like puns, Joyce is a good place to be.
Joyce is a great place to be. Sure is. And I've had, and to finish the thought, I've had a lot of audience members ask me, is there any way for you to like throw the text up on a wall while you're doing this? And so I'm going to oblige them for this show coming up this weekend. I think it's time to conduct the experiment. I'm going to share the stage with Joyce's text. You have the option of watching me or reading the text as it runs beside me. I've even done a little bit of text animation through PowerPoint and so on, so that you have a choice now. It's less you have to watch me the whole time. So, you know, I'm running the risk of being upstaged by the text, but I think it's a risk worth taking.
We're talking to Adam Harvey about his upcoming performance, Don't Panic, It's Only Finnegan's Wake. Why did you call it that?
Well, because when people ask me, you know, hey, what do you do? And I tell them I perform Finnegan's Wake. Sure enough, they start hyperventilating, their pupils dilate. But it does have to do with this kind of attitude that's happened. I mean, Finnegan's Wake is in, what is that, you know, around about the turn of the century, Random House came out with the top 100 books of the 20th century, and Finnegan's Wake's on it. So there's like this sense of obligation to have it on your bookshelf. But there's this phobia of actually opening it up and giving it a try. It does challenge you. And I think in particular, I mean, you know, I take the New York Times, I take the Review of Books, I take the New Yorker. And anytime somebody is forced to mention Finnegan's Wake, it's very difficult for them to not do so with a tone of resentment. I think in particular, there was this, a new Thornton Wilder biography came out recently. And in the review of that biography, you're never going to be able to talk about Thornton Wilder and his life without talking about the tremendous amount of devotion he exhibited for Finnegan's Wake. He studied it and studied it and studied it and made notes on it and sent letters to Adeline Glasheen so she could put them in her book. And there's a book that came out in about 2000 of his letters that he wrote to Adeline Glasheen. And it's like a 1,000-page book. I mean, this man devoted so much time to it. And so you can't mention his life and his works without mentioning his love of Finnegan's Wake. But damned if that reviewer in the New York Times didn't speak of Finnegan's Wake as this enormous waste of time. Yeah, what a shame he didn't start drinking instead. I swear to God, this is what this guy said. And so in a way, I've come to understand that it's time to put that out there at the front of the show. Like, put a big Don't Panic in stencil. As you enter the theater, please, just breathe, enjoy yourself.
Well, if they've gotten to the theater, they've already overcome step one of their panic.
Okay, let me make an argument then. Let me make an argument for Finnegan's Wake. You know, there's this thing called truth, and there is an objective truth out there, okay? And language is one means of getting at truth. But the problem is that we human beings sometimes don't like the way things are. And so we use language to distort reality. We don't use it to describe reality properly. And in fact, most of the English language or any language is generally used to distort reality, not depict it. And so what I think...
Are you talking about literature?
No, language. I'm talking about language.
I am drinking my chai from this yellow cup.
Okay, that's fact enough. That's fact enough. But there are words that get tossed around quite a lot that nobody really knows the meaning of, but they sure do sound like they do. Let's use the word liberal or the word freedom. I don't know what those words mean.
Well, they mean things to the people who say them.
But do they?
And they have coded meanings.
Or are they just sound bites? The point is that I think Joyce was aware of this, and one of the exercises of Finnegan's Wake is to distort language so that reality can once again come back in.
Which is a kind of circuitous process to this objective truth, is using, which we shall see in just a moment, words that Joyce himself simply made up.
Right. Well, he made them up, but he culled them from all sorts of different sources. Generally, it's actually a word that was coined by Lewis Carroll, a portmanteau word. In other words, it's like a suitcase. You can pack all sorts of things into it if you make up a new word. And generally, they're made up of words from other languages and so on. And the idea is the word then is allowed to be expanded into more than what you thought it meant. For example, the word exile gets turned into aches-iled, and it gets to be both the illness that he suffered from and maybe the heart pain he suffered from at having to leave his native country.
Would you like Adam Harvey to read or recite, whatever you prefer, a passage from Finnegan's Wake?
I would like to. This is the same passage that I did in 2006 when I interviewed with you before, and I thought it might be fun to do this again. There's this song, it's this kind of nice little piece of Irish nationalist blarney called The Exile of Erin. It's a lovely little tune. The song goes like this. There came to the beach a poor exile of Erin. The dew on his garments was heavy and chill. For his country he sighed, when at twilight repairing to wander alone by the wind-beaten hill. And Joyce then went with that, and it's a lovely little tune, and turned it into a question. And here's the question. I'm not going to sing it, but he's taken the lyrics and he's distorted them into this. If you met on the binge a poor exiled from ailing, when the tune of his tremble shook shimmy on shin, while his contrary raged in the week of his wailing, like a rugulent, pugilent lion o' Lynn, if he maundered in misliness, plaining his plight, or played fox and lice, pricking and dropping hip's teeth, or wringing his handcuffs for peace, the blind blighter, playing doof and dom nostrums for thome thinks to eath, if he weeped while he leaped and caballed quith a quimper, made cold blood aboo Monday and no bones without fleck, taking kiss, cake, or kick with a suck, sigh, or simper, a diffle to larn and a dibble to leck, if the fain shinner pegged you to shave his immartial, wee skill mustard shoal with his ooh, hoodoo-doo, broking wind to that wiles, woe-made sin he was partial, we don't think, Jones, we'd care to this evening. Would you? Now you made the observation that it was very Dr. Seuss-ish.
It is very Dr. Seuss-ish.
And Theodore Geisel did read, did pick up Finnegan's Wake. I think a lot of people you may not know picked up Finnegan's Wake. John Lennon did. No doubt Douglas Adams did. Speaking of Don't Panic,
right.
Douglas Adams, I mean, how are you going to come up with a name like Zaphod Beeblebrox without having at least cracked open Finnegan's Wake to see if there anything fun might be waiting for you?
Well, I think fun is the operative word.
Yes,
I mean,
ma'am.
Listening to my experience, I went, ladies and gentlemen, to the rehearsal, one of the rehearsals in which Adam was doing this performance, which we are going to see this weekend. And I had the experience of, well, a couple of things. One, just letting it wash over me. Mm-hmm. And not trying to understand, just letting it in and seeing what happens.
Liquid language.
Liquid language. And the experience of, you know, when you're maybe a little tired and you put on a movie, but you start to doze off, but you're not really quite asleep, and the language of the movie mixes with the language of your
subconscious, yes.
And it goes together. And then you wake up and you don't know quite what it meant, but it was very resonant and meaningful to you. That's what it felt
Amen.
Like watching this.
Amen. The experience, there are several inroads to Finnegan's Wake. And one of them is the idea that this is a sleeping consciousness, or maybe, as you said, kind of a half-waking, half-sleeping, where there is kind of a cut-and-dry language to it. But then at the same time, if the mind has been been forced to relax a little bit, and suddenly words are allowed to stretch over into other words and blend together and so on, then this new understanding, I think, becomes possible where it wasn't before.
Now, if you've had a glass of wine before the performance, that might just be okay.
Okay. But, I mean, don't come in, you know, don't come in.
No, not inebriated. No.
Right. But hopefully something close to that same inebriation is possible just by showing up and listening to the text.
Yeah.
I was going to mention that, like I said, there are several inroads to understanding what the language of Finnegan's Wake is. I've given a couple. Dream language, the other one I said was that, you know, why not redistort language since language already distorts reality? And there was another one that occurred to me, and actually it formed the basis for the reason why I chose this particular material for this particular show. Kind of the subtitle of this show is Bits of Joyce's Masterwork. And so I'm going to give it out in bits, smaller sections culled from different sections of the book, with a general theme that links them. And in this case, it's childhood. I remember when Beverly Powell, a wonderful woman, saw a performance I gave and found herself reliving a childhood memory of when she was still acquiring the ability to understand language but hadn't quite gotten there yet and was listening to adults talk in their super sophisticated way and being able to catch this and that and so on. And she said that it was a journey back to childhood for her.
Very interesting.
So I thought, what a great inroad. And so sure enough, there's tons about childhood, very specifically about childhood in Finnegan's Wake. There are fables, quite a few of them. And Joyce actually makes it so that you can recognize the title of these fables. One of them is The Ant and the Grasshopper by Aesop. Another one is The Fox and the Grapes, again by
what
Aesop.
What are the titles that find in Finnegan's Wake?
Okay, well, in Finnegan's Wake, he calls it The Ondut and the Grasshopper, O-N-D-T, and I don't understand that distortion. Sometimes he distorted for the sake of distortion. And Grasshopper, The Ondut and the Grasshopper. And the other one, instead of the fox and the gripes, you have the muksa. And did I say the fox and the gripes? See, I'm so used to referring to it in Joyce's terms and not in Aesop's. It's the fox and the grapes is turned into the muksa and the gripes. And in that particular story, and I'll talk about this in the show, Joyce actually makes a journey from Aesop through Grimm and actually ends up writing in the style of Hans Christian Andersen, in particular The Little Mermaid. And it's a stunning tour de force of not just linguistic distortion, but stylistic imitation, very much like what you get in Ulysses. People speak, by the way, of Finnegan's Wake as a universally uniform book in its difficulty. It's not. Every single chapter is written in a completely different style from another.
Some might be better for beginners.
There are a couple that are pretty darn accessible. I would say chapter 2, no problem. I mean, of course it's going to still have weird neologisms in it. But yeah, sure enough, that's a pretty straightforward cut and dry narrative. The point is that the book is circular. It would be better bound on a Rolodex than in a normal book because there's a sentence that ends the book and a sentence that begins the book, and both of them are incomplete.
Well,
that's the thing. The final sentence is, away, alas, alone, loved, along, the. And there's no period. And it ends on the word the single most incomplete way to end it.
Right.
And the opening sentence of the book does not have a capital letter. And that is, river run past Eve and Adams from swerve of shore to bend of bay brings us by a commodious vicus of recirculation back to Hoth Castle and environs. So you can link the two.
Right.
And you get away alone, alas, to loved, along the river run past Eve and Adams. So the point is that any place in the book is a place to begin.
We're talking to Adam Harvey about his performance, Don't Panic, It's Only Finnegan's Wake. Now, when you perform this, as you said, you're going to have the text of what you are saying up on the screen so people can watch you. They can also look at the text. They can do whatever they want.
Right.
And they can close their eyes. They can let it wash over them. You are alone on stage, not a lot of props and costumes, maybe
right.
little hat, things like
that. Maybe a bowler hat, just because it seems like such a, you know, you want to put yourself up there as a performer. I don't want to come across as giving a lecture. This does need to be theatrical from beginning to end.
Oh, yeah, and it very much is. But what I was wondering is, do you play any characters? Does that come forward?
Yeah, I've been toying around with the idea of starring Adam Harvey as Joyce Geek, or something to that effect, you know. Where the character I'm playing, you know, the character that introduces these bits of Finnegan's Wake, is not me, although obviously, you know, there might be one or two similarities between me and the character Joyce Geek.
you think?
One or two. But nevertheless, there's going to be kind of a persona, a stage persona that's going to introduce the material. I'm still working it out, you know. But
there aren't exactly characters that you play from the text.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm sorry. Maybe I misunderstood the question, because, yeah, absolutely. There is the character of the Muxa. There is the character of the Gripes. There is an aunt. There is a Grace Hopper. There are characters. Now, it's interesting, when you say that there are characters in Finnegan's Wake, they, just like the language, the characters blend into each other, and sometimes you can't even tell the difference between male and female. Not even gender is something that you can really lock onto as an absolute in Finnegan's Wake. After all, we're talking about the subconscious. I mean, I don't know about you, but I've had gender-flipping dreams, you know. We like to imagine ourselves in our waking world as we are in the world, as having a specific role. This is who I am. Regardless of who we are, whether we're Jennifer Lopez or Osama bin Laden, there's a role we're playing. And that's how we... But, you know, you go to sleep, and your mind is no longer allowed to assign that role to yourself. Suddenly, right. Everything that you've pushed away, you know, trying to define who you are, you've also had to go to the trouble of defining who you aren't. All of that stuff is going to come right back in on you when you're asleep, because you no longer have control over those things.
And so that's part of what comes out in Finnegan's Wake.
Absolutely. In fact, the main protagonist, or at least the one that most people kind of assign as the main protagonist of Finnegan's Wake, is a man. Not just a man, but a Dubliner man who has a political ambitions. He's a tavern owner. And therefore has a very strong sense of self, a very strong sense of who he is, and, you know, he's going to do the manly thing and so on. And so I think it was Edmund Wilson that called it the nightmare of H.C. Earwicker. That at one point he's called that. He's called any number of names, you know. But at one point he's called Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker. And the idea is that this nightmare comes in on him, and it disrupts all of these, you know, values that he's tried to assign to himself. And so, yeah, and indeed, the female, while it does kind of play the nurturing role that you might expect that you see throughout Western literature, it also threatens him, you know, that there's a side of himself that he's been denying, you know. And so when he goes to sleep, those other selves erupt on him, you know, and intrude on him. And so it can be seen as a highly, just depending on your attitude towards it, can be a source of tremendous anxiety, or it can be a source of tremendous release. And in Finnegan's Wake, of course, it's both. It's always both. If the answer is, wait, is it this or is it that? The answer is yes. Ultimately, in Finnegan's Wake, he loves to blend opposites. Joyce constantly combines a term with its absolute opposite to make certain that it's all in there.
Yeah. Now, you've been reading this book for a very long time.
20 years, yeah.
And what is that process like for you? Is it a daily practice?
Not daily. There was a time, of course, the first 10 years or so. I mean, I'd give it 10 years, you know. I mean, what's 10 years in a single life? That's not that much, you know. Sit down with it for about 10 years, and it's just marvelous. And, yeah, there was a period where I was doing it all the time. I mean, I was this ambitious little, I guess, what, I was in my mid-20s when I first picked it up, and it was an obsession. I mean, I really was geeking out. I was a little hermit. Collected over 100 books on, you know, on Finnegan's Wake. You know, everything from exegesis to summary to paraphrase. I own like 4 or 5 lexicons. I've got a gazetteer. All of these amazing works, and just started collating all the data and really trying to feed as much information as I could about the text into this, you know, brain of mine. It's something anybody can do. I personally recommend geeking out. I mean, not necessarily on Finnegan's Wake, but I think
on anything that draws you in, really.
Geekery is so healthy. It sends you onto so many different adventures. It's just it excites me that the word is now used. It's no longer a pejorative in our culture today, and I think that's just a really, really healthy thing.
We're talking to Joyce Geek Adam Harvey. So what has the process of putting this particular performance together been like? You've done a lot of different performances of Finnegan's Wake, and each one is different from the last.
Yeah. The main difference, I'll contrast this with its extreme opposite. In Cornell, I performed chapter 9 of Finnegan's Wake in its entirety from beginning to end, with a single break in between for the Joyceans at a conference that they were giving at Cornell University. And the piece lasted 2.5 hours.
How did they respond?
I could tell. I mean, and these people were hardcore Joyceans. I mean, these are people who had been studying it and studying it. Tenured professors. I mean, people that actually I was so honored to perform for, because, I mean, it was their material that I had been relying on as I was, you know, as I spent those first 10 years studying the book. But I could see even they were like, by the end, they were struggling in their seats to just, you know, it's a taxing process. 2.5 solid hours
to do anything
of text, and let alone Finnegan's Wake text. I mean, I recognize it's a challenging experience, and while it was such a pleasure to put that chapter up, it's called the chapter is called The Mime of Mick, Nick, and the Maggies, and that is I'm going to perform like the final 4 pages of it for the show. It is this magnificent exploration of childhood and loss of innocence and actually the dark side of childhood is contained in it too, because children can be terribly mean to each other and they play all these games with each other. And so the street games that these urchins play are really kind of little rehearsals for the way we're going to behave when we're adults. We're going to go to war. We're going to get married. We're going to have, you know, all of these different things that children do. In any case, the point is that while it was a delight to do it, and I was up there it was an athletic experience for me, and it was cathartic and, you know, really very therapeutic for me. And for some folks, they loved it, but I could see that by the end of the evening, they were all ready to go home, you know. And I just, I recognized that I probably do need to get it out in bits, you know, and say, and even like, you know, the longest section I've got here is maybe 7 pages, maybe not even, you know, the mooks and the gripes, but.
So it's 10 minutes here, 15 minutes there, five minutes there.
Right. The longest piece is 23 minutes, and that's as long as I'm ever going to go, you know, for a single stretch. And even within that, I might stop and say, what do you think of that word, you know, or something to that effect.
Right.
But for the most part, it's, you know, it'll be, you know, a straight text, because I do think there's value in just swimming in that ocean of language for a little while. But instead of dropping you in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, maybe I'll land you a little bit closer to shore, you know.
And so you'll be framing each section that you read with some conversation.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah, like what I was saying about, you know, Aesop fables, you know. You recognize this. Let's talk about why Joyce might have chosen this fable as opposed to another one, and so on. Maybe even take a single word and kind of expose it like I did with exiled or something to that effect, and just give folks an idea about what Joyce was trying to do and what I'm trying to do, and help. And not only that, just give them a moment of straightforward, cut-and-dry language so they can breathe for a minute before we jump back into that big ocean of words.
Adam Harvey is an actor. He is performing his one-man show, Don't Panic, It's Only Finnegan's Wake, at Teatro Paraguas this weekend, Friday and Saturday, the 31st of January and the 1st of February at 7 o'clock in the evening, and then Sunday at 2 in the afternoon.
Right.
And if people want more information or want to get tickets in advance, how do they do so?
They would do so by contacting Paraguas. Argos McCallum, I should send a big send-off to him.
Thank you, Argos McCallum.
Thank you, Argos. Good Lord. I walked in and he said yes before I said anything. Anyway, here we go.
Adam's a very good actor, by the way. You've been in a lot of other things, theater work and a lot of other performances.
Exactly,
so it's not just this that you do.
I've been an actor of very high caliber. I've been working with Wendy Chapin for about 6 years now.
Who's an acting coach.
Who is an absolutely stunning acting coach. Truly insightful and well-experienced, well-honed acting teacher. I highly recommend her. And I've been working with O'Neill and Shepard and Wasserstein and all these other
great playwrights.
Straight plays. And that's been it's been wonderful to get back into that. And I've been doing what I can to apply some of those principles as well to this work. And I think it does work. Yeah.
Teatro Paraguas is at 3205 Calle Marie here in Santa Fe, and the number is 424-1601. You can also go to teatroparaguas.org. Adam Harvey, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
My pleasure. Thanks, Mary Charlotte.